Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast. Modern Britain's going through a period of unprecedented division, but for once, it's not politics that's cleaving us in two. An increasing number of women are entering into the institution of marriage with their dream partner, themselves. In her cover piece this week, Ariane Shireen investigates the women who have brought a new literalism to saying, I do. But is this just a quirky fad? Or are we witnessing a profound social change in the way that women approach romantic unions? I'm joined now by Ariane Shireen and Spectator editor Fraser Nelson. So Ariane, in your piece you talk about women marrying themselves. What on earth is going on?
So there are an increasing number of women who have decided that because they don't have a man, maybe some of them don't want a man, they've given up looking, they're getting on, well, in terms of marriageable age, you know, maybe they're my age, 36 or older, and they've decided, well, if I can't find Mr. Right, I am going to embrace myself and marry myself, and it's going to be a really positive and really self-affirming ritual. I'm going to invite all my family, my friends, my loved ones, have a great big party, wear the dress, look amazing, and have my big day, man or no man.
But why bother doing that? I mean, what's the point of that?
I think it celebrates the modern woman and celebrates independence and being confident. Some of the women are very staunchly feminist, others maybe not so much, but they've decided that they're not going to let society dictate to them what they should do. Although I personally think that the female obsession with marriage does stem from being sort of socialised into, you know, wanting that from an early age. But they've decided to flout convention and stick two fingers up at whatever society might think, and hey, they're going to have their big day.
And Fraser, do you think what Ariane's talking about is indicative of a larger trend?
Well, you can argue that how many normal people get married to themselves surely is the ultimate act of narcissism. And we are only talking about a handful of people, like, you know, Tracy Emin, and, you know, people marrying a goldfish or a rock or stuff. Sure, that is, you know, pretty crazy if you ask me. But where I think her piece resonates so much is because it's emblematic of a wider trend. And that trend is that women who, you know, get to, I don't know, Ariane says 37, but, you know, of that kind of age, where they might be expected to have found a man, and they're not Bridget Jones-style crying, thinking there's a massive gap in their life where a man should be. But these women are content, they're happy, they're fulfilled. They don't particularly feel the need to go through these rather strange and debasing mating rituals, having to go to speed dating or armpit sniffing, to use the last assignment Ariane went on for us. And I think it's reflecting of the economic trend that it used to be the case, say 25, 30 years ago, that women, especially women who left school without any qualifications, absolutely needed to find a man for economic security, to find her own place in the world. Now, the economy has changed, so the shift away from manufacturing to services creates lots more opportunities for women. So women can get economically everything they need. That's far easier now. They can also find, because there are more single women, this becomes self-reinforcing. So you have a social network, so you don't really feel lonely. Now, the same trend is making it more difficult for men. Men who leave school really struggle to find a place in the economy. So women, the girls they went to school with, are complaining that they're running out of marriageable men. Now, they don't mean rich men necessarily, just a man who's got his stuff together, a man who's got a job, a man whose life is not a mess. And increasingly for women, it's not the case of when you find a man, it's whether. That's been a big shift. And I certainly know a lot of women my age who think, who are just not interested, and they don't cry themselves to sleep every night. If they were to be a fantastic man, sure, they consider it, but they are not going to compromise, nor do they need to.
That's all well and good, but it becomes a bit more complicated when people want to have children. As you make the point in your piece, it's very hard to raise a child by yourself. So these women who are deciding to do this, are they just also saying, we don't want to have children, or are they admitting that they're going to take on that extra responsibility?
I suppose it depends how well off they are, because a lot of women can't afford to have children. They have to put their careers on hold, like I did. And it's very, very difficult when you can't provide for your child. And also, childcare is extremely expensive, and you don't get a lot of maternity allowance once these days, or maybe you didn't in the past either. So basically, it is a big, big decision. But I think it's a separate decision from whether to get a man sometimes these days as well. Like, women can get sperm donors, women can adopt.
But you still have to raise the child.
You do.
You still have to come you to do. That hurdle.
Yeah, I mean, I think every woman would prefer to have, you know, two parents for their child. Of course they would. But sometimes life doesn't work out like that.
I have to admit, I found this piece mildly terrifying. I'm in my 20s and probably by the time I'm in my 30s would like to be married and have children. So reading about all of this it slightly terrifies me, the fact that is this the future I've got to look forward to?
But isn't it an optimistic trend?
I don't think it seems optimistic at all. I think the fact that it seems to be breaking down to this position is quite.
But Ariane's not talking about women who are unhappy. They're just talking about women who've reached a level of fulfillment they'd never have thought possible. Isn't that an optimistic trend, Lara?
I just don't think they sound that fulfilled or even sane if they're marrying themselves. It just seems a bit bonkers to me.
Yeah, but for every woman who marries herself, there are probably a couple of thousand, or probably more than that, who simply think that they have got everything they need in their life and they don't need a man. Isn't that the idea, Ariane?
Yeah, absolutely. I am blissfully happy after 3 failed engagements. I will probably never get married now. And, you know, that's fine. I mean, if there are any eligible, lovely Spectator readers out there who want to contact me, that would be great. If not, then that's fine. You know, I've got my friends, I've got my daughter, I feel very fulfilled. You know, I love my work. And to be honest, I think a man would actually be a distraction from all that.
What the piece seems to be suggesting is that women are just giving up in their 30s and just deciding to be single and deciding that they want to marry themselves, rather than maybe kind of, trying to see whether they can find someone. And that to me seems a slightly daunting thing to read about.
But I suppose it depends on your view of being single. I mean, women are making contingency plans and alternative arrangements. If they can't find their knight in shining armour, then they are, you know, like me, I have 5 lodgers that I live with and we have a great time and it's great fun and I have a lot of friends and I also have a best friend who I'm intending to spend my old age with. We're both terminally single and we've decided that this is the best plan, and I think that a lot of women are finding these alternatives and that a lot of them are quite innovative, and I don't think that we should pour scorn on them because I think it's a really lovely positive thing.
I mean, the flip side of this, of course, is for every single woman there will be a single man. Now they are actually the ones I do feel a little bit more sorry for, because a lot of them are just simply finding that the women who ordinarily might have settled for them are now expecting a lot more. You need to offer a lot more to women now to be a manageable prospect, especially if you left school at a relatively early stage. Now, I think we might be, if we return to the subject in a few years' time, we might be looking at these single men and trying to work out what's going wrong for them.
And you talk about Bridget Jones in your piece. How is this different to Bridget Jones?
Well, it's very different. I mean, the whole narrative of Bridget Jones was about feeling incomplete without a man. And this is all about feeling complete by yourself. And people can make jokes about divorcing yourself and having to give yourself half the house and, you know, isn't it great that you can never be unfaithful and all the rest of it. But I actually think it's not really a laughing matter. I mean, some people might have done it tongue in cheek. But if it makes themselves feel better about their lives, and if it's an excuse for a great big party and an experience they would otherwise never have had, I'm all for it. I say go.
I spoke to a woman earlier who had actually married herself, and she seemed to think there was nothing narcissistic about it at all. At one point in the ceremony, she kisses a mirror, and it seemed to me that seems a very narcissistic thing to do, but she didn't think it was. I mean, it seems to me this is part of this kind of narcissistic trend in our society. Do you not think it's...
I actually, and this is going to be a controversial statement, but I actually think that a lot of weddings are quite self-indulgent and narcissistic. Traditional weddings, you know, you wait around all day with wasps settling on your champagne, wearing, you know, uncomfortable clothes and heels, and there are all these rituals that you have to sit through and boring speeches and interminable dinners, and, you know, it's just not...
But it's about sharing your life with someone else. It's not just about yourself.
But you're being invited to guests to worship the couple in a way, which is not that much different to worshipping the single person in the ceremony you're talking about.
Well, no, but if it's a religious ceremony, there's something quite different about that. It's not just...
Yeah, but vanishingly few of them are religious nowadays.
Maybe that's a problem.
Sara Stockström, who is the Swedish case study in our feature, actually got her vows from the Bible. So I guess you could say that that was a religious ceremony.
Quite a lot of our listeners will actually know the sort of woman Ariane's talking about. As somebody who's successful, happy, fulfilled, of marriageable age, you might say, but somebody who isn't married, isn't looking for a partner, and isn't worried about being single. Now, her friends might be saying, oh, we'll need to get you a man. Her relatives might be worrying about it, but she isn't worried herself, and nor does she feel there's something massive missing from her life. And the funny thing about Bridget Jones, the original Bridget Jones, was that it was a kind of product of its time. Somebody who was single and unhappy about the fact that they were single. If you were to remake it for today, in fact, it is being remade for today, but and I suspect that the Bridget Jones character would not be crying herself to sleep about this. She'd be getting on with her life. And that aspect, the single person who is happy, content, and pretty much reconciled with being single for the foreseeable future, is a new and growing trend, and it's a trend Ariane nails beautifully in her cover piece.
That was Ariane Shireen and Fraser Nelson. In 2014, the Iraqi city of Mosul was captured by ISIS, becoming the group's centre of operations in the region. 2 years on, and the militants still hold the city, but only just. In a Spectator piece this week, Seth J. Fransman calls a recent spate of violence in Iraq the last spasms of the organisation's grip on the territory. But the prospective recapture of Mosul comes with logistical complications. And with all sides denying the validity of the other's involvement in the offensive, how will the situation resolve itself? And is ISIS really doomed in the area? We're joined from Jerusalem by Seth J. Fransman.
You've been recently out in northern Iraq. Can you tell us a bit about what's going on out there?
Yeah, I was in Bashika and some of the other front lines of the Kurdish Peshmerga that are fighting ISIS. And what's going on out there is that the Iraqi army is very slowly making progress towards Mosul, which is the largest or the second largest city in Iraq, but basically the center and capital of ISIS operations in Iraq. And I think the Iraqi army is about 60 kilometers away, and the Kurds are also about 20 kilometers away. So the big thing is, when will they both decide to go into this last city and kind of vanquish them?
And so is it inevitable that ISIS are about to fall? Is that an inevitable thing that's about to happen?
I think it's definitely, it's inevitable, but it could take, you know, it could take some time, 6 months or a year, because this is a very slow, grinding war, and it obviously has another side to it, which is in Syria, where you also have Islamic State, and then of course you have Islamic State pockets and cells throughout the world. So even if ISIS loses in Iraq and Syria, there will still be pieces of it.
And in your piece, you talk about, you have this nice phrase that the battle for Mosul is like the race to get to Berlin between the Soviets and the West in 1945. So what's happening on that front? So we've got the Kurds and the Iraqi army. Are they both competing to get there?
I don't know if they're both competing to get there. I think that the Kurds could actually take Mosul if they wanted to. They're both competing over the post-Mosul Iraq, because the Kurds, of course, would probably like to have independence at some point, and they want to consolidate their control over areas that are Kurdish and also areas that have minority populations like Yazidis and Kakai and Shabaks and Christians. So it's a competition, I think, over some of those areas. And the Iraqi army, of course, and the Iraqi central government is very much opposed to the Kurds taking even one more millimeter of land under the Peshmerga control. And on top of both groups, you have the coalition of led by America and something like 20 or 30 countries that is, of course, doing all the airstrikes and things like that. And the coalition is trying to deal with these two competing interests.
So do you think this is essentially a symbol of ISIS's fall across Iraq and Syria, the fact that it's about to lose Mosul?
I think it's a symbol of ISIS's fall, but I think the really important thing is to see that, okay, when ISIS is destroyed, you still have an Iraqi government that has very close relations with Iran, and you have Shia militias, and you have other sectarian problems. So the fall of ISIS doesn't necessarily change everything, because you still have a Sunni Arab population in Iraq that feels that they've been dealt a strong blow by the government. So I think it's symbolic, but unless things are managed well, I think we'll see another iteration of ISIS arise, just like there was Al-Qaeda before ISIS.
Even if ISIS fall at this point? Is there a chance that they could still come back and take Mosul back again?
I mean, in some other form, perhaps. I think the most important thing about the defeat of ISIS is that ISIS committed real war crimes and genocide in that area against Yazidis, and it ethnically cleansed all of these minority communities. So I think the essential thing is that the defeat of ISIS, and one of the comparisons I would say is similar to Berlin, is that it really is the defeat of a kind of evil organization that was engaged in ethnic cleansing and genocide. And I think that's an important symbol in terms of recreating those minority rights and minority communities.
And we recently had Paul Wood on this podcast, and he was talking about how when ISIS are weak in the Middle East, it tends to have repercussions in the West, and we see them flaring up. Do you think we can expect something like that happening as Mosul falls?
I think ISIS has already decided to tell the people, the foreign fighters and volunteers that were coming from other countries, to tell them to stay home and basically carry out attacks at home. So I think ISIS has already begun a campaign of mass murder and terrorism throughout the world, as we've seen people swearing allegiance to ISIS, whether it's in Bangladesh or in Paris or all these different places. So I think we will see more of that as ISIS is defeated on the ground, and as people who are have allegiance to ISIS decide that they have to then take matters into their own hands in different places.
And in your piece, you also talk about Iraq becoming a country of refugees. How do you see that playing out in the next few years if the situation doesn't get any better?
The problem in Iraq is that you have several million refugees, and many of them are Sunni Arabs who have fled the fighting in all these large Sunni cities because that's where the fighting's been. And then you have all these minority refugees, like 300,000 Yazidis. You have hundreds of thousands of Christians and other small minorities. So the thing about Iraq is that what ISIS did was that it changed 2,000 years of history in just a few days in August 2014 by destroying all of these minority communities and forcing them to flee. So the most important thing is there needs to be a massive effort at reconstruction, something similar to the Marshall Plan after the Second World War. Because if that doesn't happen, you have millions of people that are living in shelters for 2 years. And, of course, among some of those peoples, there will be then, especially I think some of the Sunni Arabs that resent the government, that could be a breeding ground for other types of extremism.
You talk about oil prices and how falling oil prices have damaged the Iraq economy. Is that something that's quite a key part of all of this?
The oil prices have done a huge amount of damage, especially to the Kurdish region, because the Kurds were cut off briefly from Baghdad and they've been exporting their own oil. But I think something like 90% of the budget or higher than that in the Kurdish region is based on these oil exports. So I think it's done real damage to the Kurdish region, which is also kind of a democratic and diverse region. And it's caused a lot of slowdown in construction. But yeah, overall in Iraq, of course, the same thing has happened in Baghdad to a different extent, which is that oil has destroyed their state budget. And that means they have no money for reconstruction. It means there's no money for all these refugees. And it just means that it perpetuates the destruction of Iraq that's been going on for, I don't know, something like 20 or more years since the 91 Gulf War.
That was Seth J. Fransman. And finally, if the rest of our content on this podcast hasn't been sufficiently titillating, get ready for the return of the so-called bonkbuster, as Jilly Cooper releases her first new novel for half a decade. In her piece this week, Frances Robinson says that Theresa May should look no further than the naughty stories of Cooper and Shirley Conran for inspiration on how to heal Britain. After all, the first wave of these boudoir bestsellers came during the reign of Margaret Thatcher, when women were being pushed towards all sorts of freedoms. So, is the bonkbuster back for good? And what does this renaissance tell us about the current state of British politics? To answer these questions, I'm joined by Frances Robinson and The Spectator's Camilla Swift. So, Frances, in this week's Spectator, you say that the bonkbuster's back and that this quintessentially Thatcherite form is being revived under Theresa May. Why is that?
Well, I think we're looking at a kind of a perfect storm of global events that have given us the ideal conditions for a bonkbuster revival. If you look at the geopolitical situation with Russia and things, you know, that's a bit 1980s. There's a woman back in number 10. That's extremely 1980s. And there's growing inequality as well, which, you know, in the bonkbuster, it's like the extremes between rich and poor are really pushed to the maximum. So I think we're in an ideal situation for a revival.
And have we not already had a revival? I mean, books like 50 Shades Shades of Grey. Those have been around for ages. What's different about this revival?
So my personal theory is that 50 Shades of Grey isn't a bonkbuster. If you look at a bonkbuster, fine, there are rude bits in it, but really it's an excuse to look into a world, you know, like polo or show jumping or the film industry or magazine publishing, right? It's really an excuse to discover that thing. Whereas 50 Shades of Grey is more, I mean, it's basically a sort of glorified Mills and Boone. It started out as Twilight fanfic, so it's just the two of them pining for each other. Christian Grey turns up in his helicopter. You know, there's no ensemble cast. There's no gossipy, bitchy backstabbing going on. So, frankly, I don't think it deserves to be part of the bonkbuster canon.
So it's more about class than sex, you'd say?
Yes, exactly. And about the intrigue and glamour of a world. You know, whether it's like fashion and modelling or whatever. I'm trying to think of the various backdrops of all the greats. But there's all
music,
kinds of things going
on.
Yes.
And Camilla, you've read the new Jilly Cooper.
I haven't finished it, I was saying. So I was up till sort of 12:30 last night reading it. And then I have to sort of say, Camilla, you've got to go to work tomorrow. Stop staying up all night. It is very good, I have to say. I think... I know it's embargoed until the 3rd of September, so I won't say very much. But it's back in the world. So Rupert Campbell-Black, who's one of Jilly Cooper's original characters, he's in Riders, is back. He's obviously now he's a grandfather. So, but she's back in the world of horses. It's about flat racing. I think she's still going. It's amazing.
And Frances, you also talk about how bonkbusters are a better way to educate people about sex. At the moment, Fettes College are running these porn awareness classes for their students, but you think that give them a bonkbuster and that's enough.
I mean, it fires the imagination, doesn't it? Like, at the moment, you have a situation where survey after survey shows that millennials are basically having less sex, which is probably not an ideal situation, right? But there has to be some happy medium of ways of educating them between, you know, school, where it's just this total cringy experience of your teacher at the front with a cucumber and a condom, and internet porn, which is, you know, horrifyingly graphic and completely devoid of imagination. So, you know, why not? Shirley Conran's Lace springs to mind. I mean, it was basically written as a sex primer, got turned into a novel as she kind of went through the creative process. And yeah, it's just a fantastic book.
And I think if you are going to learn about sex from a book, you're probably, well, I think so you're better off reading Shirley Conran or Jilly Cooper than you are 50 Shades of Grey. So I don't know what kind of weird lessons you learn from that.
And obviously you link Theresa May and Thatcher. Do you think Theresa May has ever read a bonkbuster?
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't... I think she might have done. I think if you sort of... Maybe her shoes give her away a bit. I know she's very... You know, obviously everyone talks about Theresa May's shoes, but I think that sort of shows a spicier side, a racier side to her character. I think she probably has. And she... You know, they were big in the 80s when she would have, you know, obviously been reading. They were very popular then, so I'm sure she has. I think everyone who was around in the 80s must have read a bonkbuster.
Yeah, and Walking Holidays. Mm. Walking Holidays, also lots of reading time in the evening.
Yeah.
What better way to unwind
after? In front
of
a fire, pick up your Jilly Cooper. You can't do better than that, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's hope she's been sent a copy prior
to
shipping.
I wonder. They should have done, shouldn't they? If they haven't, they missed the big PR angle there, if they haven't done that.
So has reading Jilly Cooper now replaced watching the Olympics?
I think it probably has. I've gone from staying up late watching the show jumping, although I didn't have to stay up that late for that, but staying up late watching the cycling and watching the show jumping to going to staying up late reading my book. I don't know which I'd rather do. I think Jilly Cooper might be more exciting than winning gold. There's obviously a lot of sport in both. I think lots of people got into... I have a friend who started playing polo because she read Jilly Cooper's Polo when she was a teenager, and now she works in racing, so she works for Tattersalls. So I think, you know, they are good at getting people into sport. And I remember when I was at school, I did a talk on polo because that was basically the only thing I was interested in. And my first question from one of my friends was like, have you read the book? I was like, of course I've read the book. I mean, everyone's, you know, anyone who plays polo must have read the book. And the same with riders. I mean, everyone's read it because they are... I think Jilly, for example, does so much research into her world. She really immerses herself into the world. I know that she had a share in a flat racehorse as well, so she tends to go to everything and get really involved, and she loves racing and show jumping and all of that. So she, I mean, as you were saying earlier, it's all about the world. It's not just about the industry and the world, and she really builds up her characters and everything rather than just being a story about sex and nothing else.
Yeah, exactly. And I became a journalist because after reading Shirley Conran, I thought it would just be non-stop interviewing millionaires in Capri and flying around in private jets.
Is it not? No, it's not.
Working on it.
Frances, in your piece, you do also talk about the kind of more serious side of this, that you know, in a period when there are massive divides in inequality and class divides, that's when people get back into reading this. So do you think there's a kind of more serious aspect to all of this?
There absolutely is. So I put my serious journalist hat on and I went to the Office of National Statistics and I had a look at some of their statistical bulletins about inequality. And the fact is, you know, it shrunk a bit in the 90s and the early 2000s, and now, you know, then it grew again, and now we're basically stagnating at a level where it is higher than the 1980s. So I think when society gets very polarised like that, it becomes much more attractive to think in these escapist terms, to read these books. You know, it's like the 80s again with like Dallas and Dynasty and things like that. People are stuck at home, they haven't got a lot of money, you know, the government are cutting everything left, right and centre. And then you think, wow, I'm going to read this book about glittering escapism. And it's quite nice. But obviously a temporary sticking plaster on a very extreme problem. So hopefully, you know, and Theresa May did say some stuff about this in her first speech. You know, she said, I want to heal Britain, I want to give everybody equal chances. That's laudable stuff. So maybe she could get a bit of inspiration from the world of the Bonkbuster.
That was Frances Robinson and Camilla Swift on Bonkbusters. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not try out the magazine? We have a new trial offer for podcast listeners. Get 12 issues for just £12 by visiting spectator.co.uk/12. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.